Thank you, sir.
Okay, welcome everybody to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
For those who care to, let's have a moment of silence and then follow up with some prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are not smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up the small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open, big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And tonight we are discussing step four, and this group divides that step into two meetings because there's a lot in the book about that step. And our panel tonight is Ryan and David. We welcome them. And there's a really special thing happening at this table tonight, so I'm going to say that my sobriety date is today in 1982. And this is my group. That's sort of grace of God. All right, so step four, we have searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And what we do is we read some pages of paragraphs out of the big book, and the panel will discuss their experience with those with that step. So on page 63, we're going to start off with, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things of ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions.
David. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
David.
I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober tonight. This is my home group, and my sobriety date is today, 1989. So, step four, resentments, the number one offender. We haven't talked about that yet. We've come a long way to get to this point. For me, I'll just back up a little bit. You know, I mean, I'm not a first nighter. I didn't come to AA and think that this was a really great idea. I was willing to concede that drinking was my problem, you know, that drinking was a problem. I wanted to find ways to dial that back a little bit, maybe move the pieces around a little bit, maybe leave the white powders alone and Obviously, tequila's a problem. Maybe I could just keep the Budweiser on a Friday night. You know, I spent a long time in negotiations with alcoholism. You guys kept telling me that if I was an alcoholic, that I was in fact powerless over that. The time and place would come. I would drink again. I would lose control over the amount I take. And all those things happened to me. When they did happen to me, I would come to and just make a new deal. You know, I'm not going to do that again. I would never say I'm not going to drink again. I would just say I'm not going to do that again, whatever that is, you know. So to come to the place where we've been, and I also think it's interesting that step four, I always think of step four with step five, you know. But in the book, it's laid out with step in the same chapter as step three, which I find kind of interesting. Because he's gone to some pains, and we talked about it last week. One of the things that used to baffle me when I came to AA, two things. You said it was the first drink that got me drunk, and I just thought that was ridiculous. What's a big deal with one beer, you know? And then the other thing they told me was that if I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never, ever have to drink again. The good news is you never have to drink again, and the bad news is drinking was never your problem. And that just baffles me because I think I have a drinking problem. So to concede powerlessness, to come to a place of complete mental breakdown to the point where I'm just like, I really don't have a better idea. You know, my first surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 28 years old and suicidal. I was 6 months abstinent of alcohol. I didn't have a drinking problem. And I was riding around the city of Norfolk looking for buildings to jump off of. I would offer you that that's the best I can do against alcoholism on my own. That's me bringing all my willpower to bear on the situation, best I can come up with. So I come here and I'm like, look, I need help. And I must have believed that something other than me was going to restore me to sanity, because believe me, I tried doing everything that I could possibly do. Everything I could think of, every gym membership, every self-help book, every psychiatrist, every new girl, religion, back to the gym, maybe a new diet. I tried all these things to combat alcoholism, including trying to control and enjoy my drinking. I have that great obsession that the book talks about, you know. Somehow, someday, I'm going to find it. So to lay down and then to be willing to make a decision, to be introduced to the idea that selfishness is really my problem, you know, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, you know. The root of my trouble is that I can't stand being sober. That's the real problem. I mean, obviously, getting drunk and marauding all over the place is a problem. But the fact that I can't stand being sober is the problem. When I'm sober, man, people don't understand me. People look at me funny. I work for idiots. You know, she's not nice enough to me. You know, I mean, I'm just getting wound tighter and tighter every single day until I can get that ease and comfort that comes from taking a drink, and then I'm back on a run again. So this, and I'm a tough sell on selfishness too, because I think I'm a nice guy, right? I try to keep my promises. I have good intentions. I want you to judge me on my intentions, you know. You just judge me on what I actually say and do. I can debate that for now. But this selfishness, I'm not much, I'm all I think about. So I'm always in my head. I'm not naturally thinking about you. Eventually, I ended up drinking again. I accept that that's the idea. I'm willing to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to something other than David for the first time in my life. And then you tell me in this paragraph that I've got to go on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal health cleaning. And it talks about, I love the line, our decision was a vital and crucial step. Your third step, vital and crucial, absolutely vital, absolutely crucial, it's important, could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves that have been blocking us. So it's the man who pointed this out to me said, this means that we're going to get busy now. We're going to do your fourth step now. You know, your third step is going to wear off unless you do these things. And he uses words like at once and strenuous. But it's interesting. We're here to face and be rid of the things that were blocking us. You guys told me in that whole other chapter that my problem is that God's not the problem. God's not lost. God's not the problem. The problem is that I'm so wrapped up in myself that I am blocked off from the sunlight that is available to me. It's available to all of us all the time. But I'm thinking about me. I'm thinking about how you did me wrong. We're going to look at that stuff. Resentment is the number one offender. So we have a reason for doing this. The inventory is not a penance or a punishment. It's to discover the things that are keeping me from a relationship with a power greater than myself. And it tells me flat out my liquor is just a symptom. So it's not the problem, just a symptom of the problem. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Ryan. I'm an alcoholic.
Ryan.
This is indeed my home group also. And I had my last drink on October 24th, 2009. So, without further ado, this particular paragraph has kind of special meaning to me. And I never thought that a paragraph in a book would have special meaning to me. I first started going to Alcoholics Anonymous in January of 2009. At that point, I was very well aware that I had a drinking problem and that I could not stop drinking. And while I was in rehab, they introduced me to AA, and I like read the whole book while I was there. And I came to AA because I never wanted to drink again. And I showed up, and I went to a lot of meetings and did a lot of the things that you guys told me to do. In exactly 4 months, I got drunk. In a very short span, I went from a life that had been crumbling but was rectifiable to a life that was completely obliterated. And I remember getting to this place where I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was going to be drunk for the rest of my life. And step three, when it talks about being beyond human aid, that was something that I had certainly come to realize. Because I had done all the human measures that I could think of to try to get sober. I had gone to see doctors. I had gone in and out of rehabs. I had gotten AA's magical sponsor. I thought for sure my sponsor would get me sober. And I kept getting drunk. And so when I was prevented with the spiritual approach, I kind of latched onto it. And as a matter of fact, I was not a God person. So when I got out of that first rehab facility, I tried my first prayer. And it wasn't anything spectacular. It was just like, I don't even know if you're there, but if you are, please help me. And that was my decision. So 10 months later, when I found myself absolutely consumed by booze, I called this lady, and I told her, I'm finally willing to go to any lengths. And what she told me to do, she said, she told me to quote, of course, all the normal stuff, go to meetings and all that, things like that. But one of the things she said is, if you can't sleep at night, read the big book. And so that's what I did. I couldn't sleep at night, so I read the big book. And I remember getting to this part in the big book, and it hitting me like a ton of bricks when it said, next, we launched on a course of vigorous action. Because all of a sudden I realized, like, that's why I wasn't getting in sober in AA. Because I came to AA, I made a start, like I said a prayer and all that good stuff, but then I really didn't do much of anything else. And I was like, holy crap. So my decision to like get sober and try the God stuff was absolutely wonderful, but apparently it needs to be followed up with some more things. And so I very much was a person who wanted to dive into these things. I wrote inventory, I think, at a couple of months sober, and I was actually kind of begging my sponsor to let me write it. So,
thank you. We're going to go to page 64. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations.
Being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us. Well, am I convinced? You know, that's a good question for me. I love the way he lays this out. You know, it's like if you go to a few AA meetings And particularly if you go to open discussion meetings and if there's the topic is honesty, for instance, you're going to find out that honesty is an incredibly complex, really ornate thing, you know. You got your cash register honesty over here, and you got your rigorous honesty. You know. Anyway, all he's telling us here in this inventory is that we're just going to look at what's true. You know, it's a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. You know, so is it true is the only thing that we're going to concern ourselves with. I like the discover the truth about our stock and trade and disclose damaged and unsaleable goods. And the example that I point out here is, like, when I got here, I thought that sarcasm was a character asset. I mean, it was just something that I valued. I was very familiar with it. I valued it in you, you know? It's like, oh, man, you're going to love this guy. He's sarcastic. And you find out that the root of sarcasm, sarcasa, I think, I don't know if it's Greek or Latin, but it actually means to cut or tear flesh. So sarcasm is a fairly aggressive, harmful thing, you know, and yet I value it. I think it's an asset. It's on my shelf. I got it. You know, this is good. Sarcasm. Being hypercritical, you know, I just really think that you really kind of want to know that you're doing it wrong. I mean, it's kind of my job to point it out to you, right? These are things that I think are useful. I'm just being a good friend, being a good husband. I'd want to know if you saw me doing it, you know. So am I willing to look at these things, see the truth about them, you know? My need to be right, my need to convince you of something, my terrible fear of being embarrassed, you know? If I perceive that you have an ill opinion of me, then I have to go into action to mitigate that. I'm gonna have to pull you aside, have a conversation, make sure you really understand what I meant by that. You know, these are not assets. You know, these are just the actions of a selfish person, very concerned about himself, his comfort, his reputation, etc. So we hear a lot of stuff, you know, if you're on this side of a fourth step, I just want to encourage you that it's really, we're just going to look at the stuff we already know. You know, it's not a boogeyman, you know, there's a lot of stuff that flies around about the fourth step. People will promise you if you don't do a fourth step, you're going to get drunk. And it's true. I think if we don't do the steps, we're going to get drunk, you know, but I don't think there's anything particularly magic about this fourth step. It's just another link in the chain. It's hard to do a fifth step without having a fourth step, for instance. So yeah, all we're doing is searching out the flaws in our makeup, stuff we already know every way, and once again, for the purpose of getting rid of them. And we all came here, hopefully, to change, right? I mean, I don't know how many thousands of mornings I wake up and go, this has got to change. I've got to change. This has got to change. And then I come to AA and you suggest I do something different, and I don't want to. Thanks.
Yeah, I always hear people talk about, like, inventory with, like, this sense of dread, like it's this awful, horrible thing. Personally, I think inventory is pretty freaking wonderful. My entire life, I kind of walked around acting like I knew what I was doing, that I had it all together. I always had a plan. I always had an answer. And yet, late at night, when I was by myself, there was all these thoughts in my head, like, why do I keep messing things up? How come things never turn out right? Why does this keep happening to me? Why do I keep doing this over and over again? How come everybody else seems to be able to function and get by just fine, and I don't seem to be able to? And I had absolutely no idea what was going on. And so inventory was kind of a relief. Because when I wrote inventory and I got through to the other side of it, like, all of a sudden I understood. All of a sudden I understood why, like, I don't have any friends. All of a sudden I understood why I was, like, always angry and scared. Before, I was just kind of, like, walking around clueless, like, doing my best to get by or to not feel things. So I actually quite enjoyed it. And it was a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It was not always pretty, but certainly useful. It's like the first step in a ticket to freedom is the way I look at it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, still on page 64. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual maladies overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves, why were we angry? In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with?
All right, so we're going to consider, you know, once again, we're looking at the aspects of self. Selfishness is the root of my trouble, and the common manifestations of self that are defeating me and blocking me off from this spiritual experience that I've said that I'm seeking. And so the common manifestations, we're only going to look at three. Tonight we're looking at resentments, and next week we'll look at fear and sex. There's only three. So tonight we're on resentment. The common manifestation is resentment. And I think it's worthwhile to, you know, it was helpful to me that resentment comes from resentiment, to re-feel, you know, something. It was important to me to discern, I didn't discern it. Somebody helped me understand this, was that, you know, that anger is a basic human emotion. I got three kids. I've observed them. They get here with a full set of emotions. They can be angry. There's nothing wrong. And one thing I meant to say in the other paragraph, too, is that we're just looking for the truth, not if it's right or wrong or good or bad or up or down or this or that. All these judgments that we all kind of carry around has nothing to do. Just, is it true? You know? Like, I'll block myself off. Like, I'm mad at my mother, and then I think I shouldn't be mad at my mother because my mother's been really good to me. Therefore, I'm not mad at my mother. You see? So the truth is, I'm mad at my mother, and I feel bad about it. So resentment is the number one offender, and it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. So you do something to me, and I get angry, right? That's a natural response. You say something to me that I don't like, and I get a little irritated by it. I'm angry. That's natural. A year later, somebody mentions your name, and I say, you know that son of a bitch said to me a year ago? That's resentment. I'm still churning and burning over that. I'm still re-feeling that anger, and that's the thing. That's the thing that'll and it comes to me naturally. I don't know if other people have solved this problem, but it comes to me naturally. When I get disappointed, something doesn't go my way, that is my natural response, you know? A silly example of that, I decided today, I had some time, and I decided to go get my motorcycle inspected. And so I drove up two blocks away. The guy works in the neighborhood, and I drove up there. Hey, can I help you? I said, yeah, I'd like to get my motorcycle inspected. And he said, come back Wednesday. I was like, so that didn't fit in my world. So I kind of offered him the chance to back up on that. And then he kept repeating, yeah, just come back Wednesday, I'll take care of it. And I left, and I was pissed. And then I started doing other things, and my meditations turned to, who does that guy think he is? I mean, he's got a business. It depends on customer service. What kind of customer service is that? And I start churning it over, man, you know? Start thinking about all the other people that I could go to instead. So he says all spiritual disease comes from this, right? That's an extreme statement. And I love this because I love this one line here because it says, for not only have we been mentally and physically ill, we've also been spiritually sick. We're on page 64. The entirety of the beginning of the book and the doctor's opinion and the preface have only talked about the fact that we're bodily and mentally different, that alcoholics have a body that's different than most people. Once I put alcohol in me, a craving develops that'll never be satisfied. And that makes me different. That sets me apart as a distinct entity. I'm mentally different because if I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. But it says, this is the first time he mentions that we're spiritually sick. And then this sentence, it just glows at me. It says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That's a hell of a thing, right? I mean, that tells me if I'm willing to put my energy into the spiritual malady, and we don't have to have any debate at all about what the course is there. It's numbered 1 through 12. It's the only program AA is going to offer me. These 12 steps for the spiritual malady is the thing that ails me. But isn't that a fantastic promise that when my spiritual malady straightens out, the mental, physical come along for the ride, you know? So there's a fine, you know, statement of priority. And I'm naturally, I attack everything on the mental, physical. You know, I got a mental, physical, spiritual problem, and I want to go to the gym for it. I want to get 8 hours of sleep. I'm going to drink 8 glasses of water. I'm going to take a vitamin program. I love reading about vitamins. That excites me, you know. If I can just take something to feel better, that's a win, you know. You know, whatever, the gym membership, the exercise program, the self-help books, the knowledge, you know. I mean, if I go to the psychiatrist, maybe that cat will unlock the thing that I've missed all this time. This is just telling me, how about you just concentrate on overcoming the spiritual malady through the 12 steps? And then it just gets very specific. With resentments, we set them on paper, you know. The inspection guy. Because he didn't do what I... We asked ourselves why we were angry. He didn't do what I wanted. You know, and then what has affected? Well, it affected my self-esteem, you know, because I'm an important person, and he didn't treat me like I was very important at all. Come back Wednesday, that was a little blow to my pride and my self-esteem, and doesn't really affect my pocketbook because it didn't cost me anything. I had an ambition today. My ambition was to get that done. You know, my personal relationships might have been affected if I'd have really told him what I was thinking in the moment. So I was sore. I was burned up. So there's a very practical way to look at this stuff. And then when you do it, you'll start to notice patterns. I start to notice my self-esteem pops up on just about every single one of mine. Right?
Yeah, what he said. I was definitely very familiar with resentment. And this stuff kind of gave me some practical directions like David was talking about. I mean, these are the things that had been floating around my head all of my life. I had a list of them. I had a list, you know, my dad, the bullies in school, the screwed up guy I was dating, the people at work, my mom, whatever it was. And so this was just simply put it down on paper. And for me, just practical thing, it was easiest to just kind of like take my life into chunks. You know, who was I mad at in elementary school? Who was I mad at in high school? How about my first job? And put all of that stuff on paper. And why I was angry, I already knew that stuff. I had been reliving it over and over again for years. I love to blame those people for how badly I messed up. It wasn't me. It was just that I lived in this messed up world. So... that's all I got to say about that.
Thank you. All right, we're going to go on page 65. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent is that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived.
So, we've got practical instruction. We go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. So I like that suggestion. It was told to me to just write down everybody in your family, everybody you work for, everybody you were friends with, and then just weed out the ones that you're not mad at. And there was plenty of material for the hopper there for me. So when finished, we considered it carefully. You know, that's my first conclusion, is that other people are often quite wrong. You know, and if you go to a bar stool anywhere in America right now at this very moment, They're going to be working on the first two columns of the inventory. It's going to be, I'm mad at so-and-so because I'm mad at, so we're all familiar with this model. I'm mad at my boss because, I'm mad at her because. Those are my big two. And if you're buying the drinks, I'll listen to your column too. And then the usual outcome for me is that people continue to do that stuff to me and I continue to stay pissed off. You know, because that's really all I'm bringing. I'm just bringing one big, you know, sore toe. You know, how you doing today, David? Oh, Brad. You know, here's what that guy did to me. You know, and then the thing about fighting, you know, the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse it got. And the only thing I think of when I think about that, I think about it in sobriety, and I think about my marriage. There was a time in my marriage I would absolutely fall on my sword over a point. You know, I'm just willing to die for this. You know, I am not giving up any ground. You are wrong, and by God, you're going to understand why you're wrong, or at least you're going to agree that you understand what I'm saying to you about it. You know, and I fight and I fight and I fight, and then I'm married to somebody who doesn't fight. You know, she just keeps score. And all I can tell you is my apparent victories lost me in the end every single time. You know, and if you ever, you know, that idea that the victor only seemed to win. I mean, I don't know about you, but even when I get you to back down, even when I get you to apologize, even when I get you to say, you know what, you might be right. A guy told me that one time, the most you'll ever get from an alcoholic, and he's absolutely completely convinced that he's wrong, the alcoholic will say, yeah, you might be right. You know, that's the best. And I get that from you. And that was apparently my goal because I fought so hard to get it. You give that to me, it's hollow. It doesn't feel good. You know, it's not a victory, really. It doesn't promote any sort of harmony or peace or goodwill or kindness or decency. So these moments of triumph are incredibly short-lived. Thanks.
Thank you. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. I'll tell you, I didn't realize it for a long time, but that thoroughness and honesty tripped me up. I think I've written multiple inventories. I think I did the best I could on all of them. But as I've written successive ones, like the stuff I see has increased. Like I didn't realize it, but I had like a really big problem with not being able to admit that I was mad. Like, I don't know, it's like I'm not supposed to be mad about that, or I shouldn't feel that way, or I understand where they're coming from, and so it doesn't count. I'm seething with rage deep down inside, but because I shouldn't feel that way, it doesn't matter. And that caught me up for a long time, is like having to learn to admit when I was upset. It's been very difficult and uncomfortable problem. What that looks like a lot of times is I'll get mad for something, and it's not till like 2 weeks later that I figure out that I'm mad about it, and then I just feel like an idiot, because then what do you go back and do? Like 2 weeks ago, you did something that ticked me off, and so the levels of honesty have had to increase over time. And I've had to learn not to edit myself, to just be honest about it. I know I call my friends and I talk to them about when I'm angry, but the kind of the joke is like, don't judge me for my thoughts, right? I know that this is stupid and silly and petty and I'm just being a sad little girl, but please, I can't help it. This is what I'm thinking. And this other line that I really, really love is this. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Like, heck yes. And I hate to say it, but even today, like, before I can get anywhere, like, the person I'm talking to, you have to, like, recognize that somebody else did something wrong. Like, we've spent so much time focusing on, like, our part, and it's your fault, and it's your fault, and your fault. It's like, can we just acknowledge that I'm not the only one who does bad things here? Please? Once we do that, we can go all spiritual and what was my part and all that good stuff. But first, we have to establish that I am not the only one. Thank you very much. You know, because this idea that he talked about, I had never looked at my part and stuff. I was very much to conclude that people are wrong and stop there. And that did kind of keep me trapped for 30 some odd years. I'm not even going to lie, even longer than that, pretty much my entire life. There's probably some still things that I'm trapped by. But it is. It's because I just want to blame people. I want it to be everybody else's fault because clearly they are wrong. And I did not realize that I had a part in that. You know, I was walking around thinking I was Little Miss Innocent because I like bake cookies for soldiers or some kind of crazy kooky stuff because I didn't steal or do as bad a stuff as you did and all that nonsense. And what happened was I continued to get hurt. And as far as fighting and trying to have my own way, I see that mostly actually at work. I just like to get mad and not say anything. That's just like my favorite thing to do ever, and it doesn't go very well. Just like the paragraph says. Thank you.
All right, page 66. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison.
Okay, I'm not going to spend too much time on this one because he's going to start giving us the solution here after this, but it is plain, and he's assuming that we've written out an inventory, you know? So we got a couple of pages written down of things we're mad at. This is about a month old. Hey, my mother's on there. My mother and my third-born son is on here. Apparently, he's lazy and selfish. So we've got the list, and we look at it, and we're considering it carefully. And, you know, if you have the list, it's plain to see that a life that includes these things, you know, leads only to futility and unhappiness, right? I'm cooking a good resentment today. In fact, my kids were home from school today, and I was stewing about maybe plotting revenge on motorcycle guy, you know? And my third born was trying to get my attention, you know? He wanted to spend some time with me. Daddy. Daddy's busy. Daddy's plotting revenge, you know? That might have been an hour well spent. It could have been something that was worthwhile. And then I think about that. I mean, I know it's a silly example, but that happened today. I mean, this is just my natural bend to just have the resentment du jour, if you will. But I think about my father. My father was on this list for I don't know how many years that I squander away, you know? I mean, my drinking landed me in guidance counselor's office, principal's offices, psychiatrist's office. By the time I was 16 years old, I was familiar with these things. And they wanted to talk to me about two things. They wanted to talk to me about my relationship with my father and my drinking. And I would say, my father is a jerk, and I drink whenever I want. What else you want to talk about? You know, I just shut the door on all of that. And I would have told you, high center on a bar stool, I could get you on board. I could list the sins of my father and the way that he treated our family and the things that he said and did to me in such a way that you'd be like, yeah, man, after we close this bar, let's drive down to Florida and kick that old man's ass, you know? I could sell you on it, you know what I mean? I mean, it was a part of me, it was part of my identity, what a mean, thoughtless, selfish individual my father was, and I hated him, right? Truth is, I wanted nothing more than to have the love and the respect and the friendship of that man, you know? And I couldn't even admit that. But deep down, that's the truth, you know? And as we go through this process, there's other stuff attached to it, but because of amends and a willingness to continue and good sponsorship and 12 steps, you know, that man's been dead since 2004. The last 10 years of his life, we got to be really good friends. We got to be the best of friends. And I loved the man. And he loved me. And I wouldn't trade a minute of it. But I would say from about age 12 to age 32, I squandered a lot of hours in there in resentment, simple resentment. And I didn't have these tools. I have no way to identify it, articulate it, or get rid of it without a drink. Thanks.
Yeah, I always think about the small term squandering. I don't think too much about the big term squandering. Wow, since you just said that. Yeah, like I got ticked off about stuff when I was a kid, and it completely wrecked my ability to have relationships with people for like the rest of my life. And inventory helped to resolve that. But even today, you know, I pay attention to non-alcoholics all the time. I work with them, my family's part of them. And what I notice is like they get angry too. There's this guy at work that I call him Mr. Cranky Pants because he's just mad all the time. But here's the difference between Mr. Cranky Pants and I. He can be angry all the time because that's not going to like cause him to start drinking again and like lead him to death. Me, I can't just walk around angry all the time because that stuff will, like it says, shut me off from the sunlight of the spirit. And for me, that's anything that makes me feel happy, joyous, and free. I'm not feeling that. I can only take that pain for so long until I need a break. And next thing you know, I got a drink in my hand, and all bets are off. I know where that's going to lead me. So that is definitely a luxury that I cannot afford. And I wish I could say that I was like 100% resentment-free all of the time. However, that does not happen. And it certainly interferes with the enjoyment of the time I do have here on this earth. I remember lots of times where I'd be like out to dinner with folks and they're all talking and all of a sudden everybody's laughing and I look up and I have absolutely no idea while they're laughing. I have just missed everything that had happened because I'm like looking down at the table like replaying like the latest and greatest of like what you did and what I'm going to say to you and what you're going to say back, and then I'm going to say this and maybe you'll say this, and all this nonsense completely ruined. And it'll ruin my ability to show up for people. You know, get so ticked off. I know somebody else needs some help. I'm not thinking about them or what I can do from them. You know, I'm just sitting there stewing, and I'm so tired I can't even bother to leave the house to help you. I mean, all this stuff, and it's just a waste. It's silly. So, that's all I got.
Thank you. All right, so on 66, we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. First, we realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." We avoid retaliation and argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one.
Oh, yeah. Now we're cooking. We turn back to the list, right? Well, you got to have a list to turn back to it. And he tells me it holds the key to the future. That sounds important. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Am I? I don't know. Let's find out. So we've just written three columns so far, right? We've written I'm mad at Mr. Brown because he pays attention to my wife and that affects my sex relations, self-esteem. I'm mad at motorcycle guy because he didn't do what I wanted and that affects my pocket or my self-esteem and my ambitions. So we're going to look at it from a different angle. First thing he asks us to look at is we begin to see that the world and its people really dominate me. I love the line, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real. Doesn't matter. They might have actually done you wrong, or it might all be in your head. Doesn't matter. result is the same. You're dominated by it, you know? And it has the power to kill. How can I escape? I want to escape. I want to be free of this. Well, he gives me a course. This is our course. And he invites me to a new attitude. We realize that perhaps the people who wronged us are spiritually sick. And we don't like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us. He always gives me credit for being sane. Like, we understand, David. We understand he stepped on your toes. It's okay, little man. But that they, like ourselves, were sick too. Right? So, am I... One of the things that I noticed when I did the inventory, one of the first things that I noticed is that I'm, particularly the resentments inventory, is that I'm capable of hating you for the very same thing I'm capable of doing to you. I mean, I hate you because you did it to me. That affected me. But they like ourselves, right? I know it's like a thing in AA, right? Pray for him, he's a sick bastard, right? But that's that position sort of assumes a spiritual hierarchy, right? Like I'm obviously above it, he's obviously a poor, sick, lowly bastard, right? And that's not what this says at all. It says they, like ourselves, are sick too. Like ourselves. Well, how's this guy like me? You know? How's the motorcycle guy like me? You know, what's it like for him showing up every single day? He's got a reputation of being like one of the best mechanics in the area. He's been there for like 30 years, day in and day out. What's his life like? You know, what does it take for him to pull that off, to show up? You know, maybe that guy wakes up in the morning just like me, scared to death he's not going to make it. Scared to death there's not going to be enough money or love or attention or kindness or decency. Maybe that guy's got the very same thing I've got. Maybe he's worried. Maybe he's got sick kids. I don't know. I really don't know. But I never thought about it. And you guys asked me to think about it. Because the magic of consideration, as soon as I consider you, I begin to love you. So, like ourselves, we're sick too. And then I know it's in the story in one of the books. I know it's also popular in AA. I'm not trying to say controversial stuff, but this stuff has helped me, you know, where my sponsor told me to pray for this guy for 30 days and the resentment will go away, right? I'm sure there's nothing wrong with praying for anybody for any length of time. I'm positive of that. That's just not what this says. This says we ask God to help us show as a demonstration, it's a doing thing, the same patience, tolerance, and pity that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend, you know? If my mother or a motorcycle guy or my father or one of my kids was sick in the hospital, I wouldn't kick the door in and start yelling at them. You know? I would go in softly. I would go in gently. And I would look for ways to be helpful to them. And this is telling me that I don't have... I've already admitted that I don't have the power to do this. I need God. So the prayer is for me. Help me. Help me to see this person differently and help me show them something in the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And the linchpin for me, and that's why I share that as consideration, if I just spend a moment thinking about you, I begin, all this stuff begins to attenuate. I'm very, very not good at, in the moment when the person offends me, saying to ourselves, this is a sick man, God save me from being angry. Nah. That hadn't gotten to me yet. In the moment, I'm just offended. And in the moment, I need to retreat. That's the best I can do, is get out without doing any damage. Thanks.
Yeah, I always loved that. We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. Because as much as I love to play the, like, who's going to win the battle in my head game, it's really exciting, like the first couple of times I run it through my head, and I always come out the victor. But after a while, I just get tired of thinking about it. I just get tired of thinking about it, and I don't want to think about it anymore. And then it's 2 a.m. and I can't sleep and all this other kooky stuff, and I just wanted to go away. And I want to tell you that the spiritual course is like the go-to for me. I like to run through a few other options first. Like, I'm just not going to think about it. Like, just don't think about it anymore. Or maybe I'll just go, like, do a bunch of stuff so I don't have to think about that anymore. Spend a few hours in the gym, maybe. Candy Crush on the phone, let's kill that, whatever. All kinds of stuff. I love the memes, the little things on Facebook that people post, you know, like those spiritual things that make you feel good, like maybe that'll help it. And yet I continue to be plagued by them, and I'm like, why am I so angry? And then I come to the book, and it gives me the reminder. Ryan, the reason that you can't get rid of this resentment isn't because you don't want to or because you're not trying really hard. It's because you can't. You just can't do it. You know, and that was me all my life. I was not waking up in the morning saying, wow, I just want to be like this angry, cranky person that makes people at work want to quit. I wanted to be like happy and like, let's have fun and do stuff. And yet I couldn't do it. Try as hard as I might, I couldn't just be like that happy-go-lucky gal. And so this is what it reminds me. God's got to show me how to do this stuff. I can't do it. I always go back to something this guy said to me once, and it's always the same. It applies to just about everything. Stop trying to fix something that you can't fix. You know, work on your relationship with God and see if that stuff doesn't straighten itself out. And I love the prayers that it says, you know. We ask God to help us show them, like, God, show me how to do this. God, save me from being angry. You know, God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Because on my own, I'm not capable of doing that. In the heat of a resentment, I don't care how sad your story is, you are the worst human being on the planet and you should die. Okay? God's got to do that. And the other thing that David touched on, it's like me. You know, more so when I got to the fourth column is why I began to be able to set that stuff aside and stop thinking of you as like the worst human being ever. When I could see all the ways that I had done things wrong, quite frequently the exact same thing that I was mad at you for. When I could give myself, I know you can like diss people like self-understanding or self-love or whatever, but when I could take a look at myself and look at how all of my good intentions, because to be quite frank, I just said, I didn't want to hurt people. That wasn't like my big goal in life. That in spite of my best efforts, I had failed. All of a sudden, I could give them the space to have those same failures, and some forgiveness and things like that can start to come into play then. So, thank you.
All right, we have one more paragraph. It's on page 67. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight.
All right, so referring to our list again, we still only have three columns. Here comes the mysterious fourth column that they didn't bother to put in the book. So we're going to refer to it again. And I can't put out of my mind the wrongs that you have done until I do this, the work that was just described. You know, that invitation to a new attitude and some sort of prayerful consideration, asking God to show, right? But now that I've done that stuff and I've softened it a little bit, I can look at resolutely, like with firm focus, like just this, I'm just going to look at my fault, where I was to blame, what I did wrong, right? Because there's always a but with me, right? It's like I did this, but, you know, you really are worse, you know? So, like in the case of the motorcycle guy, I'm selfish in that I want what I want when I want it. I wanted it now. I want an inspection right now, you know? I'm dishonest. I hate to tell you guys, I've been riding around on an expired inspection for a good year and a half. But today it needed to be done. You know what I mean? You know, get out of my way when today's the day. You know? You can make a case for dishonesty there, you know? And I'm scared to death I'm going to get pulled over for that one day. Not scared enough to get anything done, you know? So this is what I'm bringing this guy. And like when I brought my father, I brought my father just endless requests for forgiveness and cash. That's really what I brought my father for years. Forgive me. I need you to forgive me and fund me. You know? So I'm self-seeking. I'm dishonest. I spend the money he gave me for college on drugs. You don't need honesty, right? Dishonest. And frightened. I'm always frightened I'm going to be found out. So I'm looking at these things, right? These are the things. This is my thing. I'm selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened in these situations, regardless of what you've done, right? And also, when you do this work, you're going to see, I see patterns. I constantly see patterns. I'm big on the selfish, self-seeking side of the thing. I want what I want when I want it. So I'm done taking your inventory. I've taken mine. And I'll just say this and shut up. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we were willing to set these matters straight. How'd the ninth step sneak in here? How'd that happen? And I will tell you that from my own experience, a lot of these resentments that I've had, particularly the big ones, you know, like the motorcycle guy today, I'll forget about that tomorrow. I won't even be able to retell that story. You know, I was mad at him about something, but I can't even remember it. But like with my father, the ones that stick. My best friend from high school, I didn't speak to for 20 years. The ones that stick. Those resentments did not even begin to attenuate until I made amends. But then I was free. Thanks.
I'll make this quick, but I just remember this whole process, the first time I wrote it, got to that fourth column, and there was one word that stuck out to me over and over and over and over and over again, and that word was I. I had done all of it. I had made the decisions I had made. I was the one who quit school. I was the one. I used to get so mad, like, how come I don't have any friends? And then I realized it was because I was unfriendly. You know? Screw smiles and hugs. You know what I mean? And I had walked around blaming everybody, wondering why I was so miserable and alone and all that stuff. And so to see that on paper, that it was me, one, it was kind of horrifying. But the flip side of that, it was because it was quite freeing. Because the truth is, the world, I don't think the world's going to like magically become a perfect place because like Ryan decided to get spiritual or whatever, because it's 2017 almost, who knows. And I'm not going to be able to like make everybody on the planet change and suddenly do all the perfect things that I know that they need to do to make everything happy. But I can change myself and start to do things differently. And so that's pretty freaking freeing. That's all I got.
Thank you. I'd like to thank our panel. Thanks, Luke. All right, we're going to pass the seventh tradition basket. The seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. This is the time for announcements, and we will be having our next Supper and Speaker on December 26th. It's a little ways out, but it's the day after Christmas, so put it on the calendar. We have some lovely green seasonal flyers over there to share with your groups. Any other AA announcements? Yes.
My name is Ashton. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah. Ashton.
VISCU Club, Virginia State Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous, is having an event October 29th in Hampton. This will be a speaker, a costume contest, and a dance. So if you're interested, please see me after. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Todd, an alcoholic.
Todd!
Brittany.
I'm
Virginia.
I'm having their 12th
anniversary
on November 3rd. Dinner is like
Myrrh
cookies. So Myrrh.
All right, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Please raise your hand if you're a home group member. Newcomers, this is the most important person in the room. Is there anyone here in their first 30 days that would like to just introduce yourself with your first name so we can get to know you? Any newcomers tonight? Okay. We do have literature available. If you can fold it, it's free. There are some other announcements over there for upcoming events. The books are for sale. Just see one of the home group members if you need a book. Sponsorship and AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. And if you have any questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, you can come up and see me after the meeting. I'll be glad to answer any questions. Smokers, after the meeting, please stay away from the front door of the church. Use the butt can that's provided out front over by the bike rack for your cigarette butts. And then we also have a website, simpleactions.net, where all of our meetings are recorded and you can listen to it at your time and convenience. And I'd like to thank the panel one more time. In the meeting tonight. Once we clean up, we meet at what's that place? Plaza del Sol.
Plaza del Sol.
The lovely Mexican eatery. Colonial and 22nd or something. If you hit the railroad tracks, you've gone too far. And can I have someone read the last couple paragraphs on page 164?
I got it.
David Gallup.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
We close with the Lord's Prayer.
Father.